Wonderful recording. Manuel Puro, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
Yeah, very well. Thank you very well. Thanks for having me. And yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about your journey through casting and all the work you're doing now with the acting habit, which we'll get to later on. But I think, yeah, first and foremost, I like to start these a little bit with sort of your backstory. So maybe we can speak to that a little bit. What was the origin of Manuel Puro getting into casting and the inspiration, and what's led you to where you are now?
Oh man, you know, it's a really long story. It's a crazy story. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but I think it set me up properly for this, for kind of understanding the whole business, really. It's just such a crazy thing. I was a student in London, and I was doing economics, and I was supposed to be going off to become a businessman or some kind of a management consultant or something. I was kind of all, I guess I was at the London School of Economics, and that was my track. And I realized very early on, within a couple of weeks of being at university, that it just wasn't for me. I just didn't connect with the course and with most of the people that I was working with. It was kind of like, what have I done? But it was back in the day, it was many years ago, when it was quite easy to stay at university in England. I didn't have to pay for anything. I would get a grant, and I got my housing paid for. So I wasn't a fool. I never considered leaving the course. I just thought, well, that's not my path, but what am I going to do? And I just didn't really know. I genuinely didn't know, but I'd always loved going to the cinema, and I'd always loved taking pictures. So I spent my 3-year university career more or less in the cinema every single day. And there was a cinema in London at the time called The Scala up near King's Cross. And they would show, it was owned by Steve Woolley. It was owned by this fantastic, who went on to become a great producer. And it was a rep cinema. It was a little bit like the Prince Charles cinema that at the moment in Leicester Square, where it wouldn't show kind of new films. It would show lots of old films. So I had this for over the course of 3 years. I mean, it was like a little mini film festival every day. And so without really trying, it was my own version of film school. It was just somewhere, it was a haven for me. And I used to go, I'd probably say 5 times a week I used to go, and I used to go for the first showing. And then when you pay for your ticket as a student, which was so cheap, it was like £1 or something, you'd pay for your first ticket, and as long as you didn't leave the building, you could stay for all the screenings. So I used to go in at 12 o'clock every day and kind of leave at 11 o'clock at night, having watched 3 or 4 films, and more or less just wasted my whole day in the cinema watching 3 or 4 films, sitting in the dark. And I would do that day after day, and I would write notes in a little diary. And it gave my life some purpose, but I knew I was just kind of whiling away the time and just enjoying my life in London without really knowing what I was going to do. And then so fast forward 3 years, it was coming to the end of my course. And whenever I did pop my head into the university, all my colleagues and people, they were all dressed now in suits and ties, and they all had briefcases, and they were absolutely ready to transition into that business world. And I was still going around in my shorts and t-shirt and kind of cycling around and going, what? And so I did what I always do, and I kind of ran to the cinema because I was just scared, and I'm just going to put my head in the sand. And I remember seeing, it was a film that I really wanted to see because I hadn't seen it, and it was Fellini's Casanova. And I knew it was showing, and it's like, great, I'll go and see Casanova. It's been on my list for a while. And I remember sitting watching the film and kind of hating it, actually hating the film, but appreciating that it must have been really interesting to make, and it must have been a lot of fun. We had Donald Sutherland swanning around. There was lots of nudity. It was just ridiculous. It was a ridiculous kind of film, really over the top. And like I said, it wasn't my kind of film, but it was my light bulb moment. It was a genuine light bulb moment where I thought, some people are making this, and some people are making a living doing this kind of stuff. And surely I could get involved, and I could possibly even do better. You know, there's me thinking I could do better than Fellini. But I just thought, well, yeah, that doesn't look like it doesn't mean, you know, it feels like I wouldn't have to wear a suit and a tie like my university colleagues. So, you know, that looks like I want to enter that world. So anyway, that was my light bulb moment, that I just thought, okay, I want to work in the film business, but I have no idea what I want to do or how to get into it or whatever. And this is maybe 25 years ago. We're talking quite a long time now, way before internet and way before a lot of film schools and things like that. So the only resource I could find was the Yellow Pages. I was in London with the Yellow Pages, which is the big telephone directory. And I flicked to F for film, and under film, there were about 10 pages worth of entries. And it was a real mishmash of some companies, some that I recognized, lots that I didn't. There was kind of film processing was all under the same category. So so some of it I could see was, at the time, it was before digital cameras, when people had holiday photographs, they would send it. And so some of that was all lumped up. I thought, well, that's not what I want, but I could recognize some film company names. And then there were lots of just names and addresses and a phone number, because without me really knowing what any of them were. But anyway, I came up with all sorts of different, I did the kind of the traditional thing first. I sent letters to people. So the first 10 on the list, I sent a letter and I had zero response. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to have to be a bit more creative. And so I tried all sorts of different methods to get a bit of attention. And most of them didn't work. And it took a while to just trying lots of kind of crazy things. And I eventually hit on one idea. And it's a really long story, so I will try and shorten it. But basically, I created a photograph that had a handwritten letter inside this photograph that just said, you know, I'm really into film, and please, you know, I'd love to get a job in film. It was a very kind of obscure sort of little handwritten note within a beautiful photograph that I'd composed myself, and I'd been able to. So I photographed it, and I was able to print off a few copies. And as part of my letter, part of the letter, the last line of it, the letter. Well, I had this other idea about there's a chocolate bar called a Kit Kat, and a Kit Kat in England has been it's been advertised, have a break, have a Kit Kat. That's the tagline. That's been the tagline for, you know, ever since I was a kid. So it was have a break, have a Kit Kat. And so I sent this photograph to people, and within this kind of handwritten letter that was inside the photograph, the last line was, and since I've supplied the Kit Kat, you could give me the break, because I wanted to break into the film business. And so I sent a photograph and a Kit Kat to 10 people, and it was fantastic. I had 10 phone calls the next day. I had 10 people kind of, because there was no, it wasn't anywhere near a formal resume. Nobody knew what gender I was, it just had a phone number there. It was kind of like, who are you? What are you? You know, what could you do? And so nobody really knew, but they were curious, and it was the thing that got me noticed. So I went in and I saw a few people. I saw a sound recorder, sound editor, I mean, and that blew my mind. He was putting the sound onto a documentary, and I was just, it was extraordinary how he did that. And I met some editors, and I went in to see some production companies and a couple of producers. But there were no kind of jobs out of it. It was just an exploratory time. And so I had a phone call from somebody who said, so I kept sending out my Kit Kats and my photographs, because it seemed that was getting attention.
You were keeping Nestle in business at the time.
I really was. I probably still am. They're probably still my chocolate bar of choice. I owe a lot to those Kit Kats. So, you know, and that tagline. But I did, I kept sending it out, and I got a phone call one morning from somebody, and he said, oh, how soon can you get here? And I said, well, where are you? And he said, I'm in Sloane Square. And it was about 30, kind of like anywhere in London is about 30 minutes away. And he said, about 30 minutes. He said, great, I'll see you then. So I didn't really know who it was. And it was just a name. And I didn't know, again, it's not like you could quickly go on the internet and find out who somebody was. It was just a name. And it was somebody I obviously sent something to. But so I went along to the address that I was given, and pressed on the buzzer, and it was a nice address right on the King's Road, it was a really swanky address. It was nice. I thought, oh, this must be good. And I pressed on the buzzer, and the voice on the intercom said, first floor. So I went up to the first floor, and I entered this office, and it was tiny. It was the grubbiest, tiniest little kind of office you could see. And there was a couple of desks, there was a sofa, there was an old computer that wasn't really working. And it was just it was really small and messy is my main impression of that room. And there was one man in it with kind of sort of with wild eyes. And I kind of said, hi, my name's Manuel. And he said, I'm sorry, I haven't got any time to chit chat. Would you just have a read of the script? Sit there, read the script, and kind of stay out of the way. And at first I thought, well, that's a little bit rude, but, you know, let's have a look. I'll just sit down and just see what happens. And it was very strange. At the time, I didn't really have much of a job, and I was staying with a friend of mine who did go and work in the city and was very wealthy. And I really thought that he had set something up. I thought this was some kind of joke, because it felt really weird. Oh, this guy sat at the phone, and he had all the old rotary phones. There were about 8 on the desk, and all of them were ringing all at once. And he would be picking it all up and saying, no, we don't have $1 million for Ben Kingsley, and put the phone down. And then he would make another phone call, and he would be mentioning all these actors' names and all these amounts of money and different things. And not really keeping on top of all the phone calls, and when he didn't know how to put anything on hold, and so he would just lay the receiver on the desk, and you could hear the little tinny voice kind of going, Jeremy, I'm still here. And so after a little while, though, the buzzer went again, and he went over to the intercom and he said, darlings, I'm on the first floor. And then he put the thing down and he turned to me and said, right, what's that script about? And so I quickly told him a little bit about what I thought the script was about. And he said, and who should be in it? And because I'd been for 3 years going to cinema all the time and making my little notes, it was back in the day when my memory was good. And I was able to kind of reel off a few names. Oh, well, there's this actor or that actor or this actor and that actor. And I knew it took about 30 seconds from the front door to get up into the office because I'd just done that journey myself like half an hour earlier. And so I know we didn't have much time before these people turned up. And so so this guy, who was called Jeremy, said, oh, okay, great, that's great. Now go and sit in the corner and kind of work on that computer and look busy, but don't worry about anything. Don't say anything, just kind of look busy. And so I went and sat in the corner, and then the door opens and Jeremy welcomes in a producer and director. Darlings, I loved your script. It was amazing. And he carries on to have this whole meeting, and he mentions a lot of the names that I had been sort of talking about. And it's, I mean, you know, looking back on it, it's not hard. It was all the famous people that almost anybody would say, oh yeah, here's Tom Cruise and here's whoever, Brad Pitt or whoever it was. Oh. And but Jeremy had this whole kind of meeting, and it was really, I was absolutely gobsmacked because I just didn't really understand what was going on. And during that meeting that he was talking to a producer and director, it was kind of, again, the first time I think I'd ever seen a real life producer and director. And I noticed some posters, some film posters around on the wall. And one of them was a poster for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. That was a huge film at the time with Kevin Costner. It was a massive film in the UK. And there, right on the poster, was this guy's name. It was like, wow, casting by this guy. And I thought, well, that must be pretty good. His name is right on the poster. There's not many names on that poster. And as soon as those guys as soon as the producer and director went away, Jeremy turned to me and he said, oh, yeah, could you just hang around until the end of the day? And then at the end of the day, he said, come back tomorrow. And it carried on like that for quite, you know, yeah, well, it just carried on like that for 7 years, more or less. Yeah, come back tomorrow. And it turns out he was Jeremy Zimmerman, and who's a legendary casting director, Jeremy. And he, I just had the massive good fortune that his assistant, at the time, he had a brilliant assistant, but she was not well that day, so he was just desperate just to have somebody else in the office. Wow. And so he called me because Jeremy, God bless him, at the time, every day you would get 10 by 8 photographs. We would get a whole stack of these 10 by 8 photographs, and my letter was also just a 10 by 8 photograph. And Jeremy, to his credit, every day would open these things himself. He always opened it. That was his process. Get into the office. He personally would open all the envelopes, look at every actor's CV and every actor's photo, because that's way before email. That's how actors, that's how we found out about new people. And so I guess he was sitting there kind of thinking, what am I going to do? I've got no help today. And he opened one of them and this Kit Kat fell out, and then this weird photograph came out. And then hopefully I was normal enough for him to kind of stay. But yeah, and honestly, I ended up staying there for about 7 years. I mean, quite quickly after I started working, after a few days, his assistant came back. She's called Andrea Clark, and she's still casting now. Right. And she's and it was great because Jeremy actually went away to Amsterdam to cast something, and so he was away for a couple of months. So it meant that I could really learn from Andrea just how it really all kind of ran and how everything kind of worked. Because when Jeremy's around, it's just great. There's lots of adrenaline and it's exciting, but it can feel a bit chaotic. And so it was kind of nice that I saw that side of the office. Then it kind of went calm because he was somewhere else, casting somewhere else. And but yeah, that's sort of, so I didn't know casting existed. It wasn't a job that I was looking for, or that I even thought anything that I would ever be good at or anything. I completely fluked into it by just having this incredible good fortune. And that's my origin story.
Serendipity and like a passion for film, obviously, that kind of together. You do realize this is a film in of itself, right? Like, you do realize you've got something in there that you could definitely make.
Well, it just keeps going. I love it. I love I mean, Jeremy has just been amazing and an amazing kind of mentor, I suppose, because that wasn't my only bite of the cherry. I worked with Jeremy for all that time, for about 7 or 8 years, I think it was. And I just about started to cast some things myself under Jeremy's kind of umbrella. And it was my first job, and you know, it was really my first job in film, and it was kind of, and I absolutely loved it. I loved the whole process. But I then got headhunted by an agent. An agent called and said, "Hey, listen, would you know, come and talk to me because I wouldn't mind you working on." By that point, we were kind of quite close, and I just enjoyed running the office, and you know, it was just a great job. But there was this opportunity to try something else, and the agent was a real kind of top level agent, and I just thought, gosh, that's really interesting. So I spoke to Jeremy, and he was just the most gracious, and I mean, he was just brilliant. He just said, "You have to go and do that. That's such an opportunity. You must go and do that." And Jeremy turned this thing into a complete celebration. He took me to the Ivy to kind of celebrate that this thing. You know, I thought he'd be distraught. Well, I don't know. It's just one of these. Maybe I'm overstating my importance of in the office, but he was just so amazing and so kind of like, "No, you must go and do this, and it's great." And
this was after like 7 years. Was it six?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so he and he just made it into this kind of great celebration, and that's when I then went and worked for an agent for a little while.
And obviously, you've been working with agencies through the 7 years with Jeremy, but it's a different kind of skill set in some ways, right? So, what was the transition like? Because I guess you had to adjust to a slightly different way of working, although it's still the same industry. Did you have
it was great. It was the other side of the, I mean, it's the same coin really, but it's just the other side of the same coin. And so it was just great to be able to see it from that side. And the guy I worked with was just, again, another, I mean, I've been so lucky. He probably still has this kind of reputation. He had a reputation of being really, really hard to work for. And he was a screamer and a shouter. There was all that kind of side of it, but he just had the most extraordinary client list, and actually everyone that works for him is kind of very loyal to him because he just expected kind of excellence. But when you mess things up, he would absolutely be in your corner, and he would show you how to solve things. And it was you'd be afraid to kind of say, "Oh, I really messed this up and this has gone wrong," and it would be like, "Right, battle stations, and let's fix it, and here we go." And it was it was just an extraordinary time. I mean, he really is the top level, and the client list was just to die for, just Oscar winners left, right, and center, and just household names. And it was just fascinating to see the whole business from that side and see, again, how a really good agent, because he was, and I mean, he clearly is just an incredible agent, how he had everything together and how he handled the clients, and especially as this, like anything, it's to do with the crises, how you handle the crises and how you solve problems. It was a fantastic experience. I knew I didn't want to be an agent, but it was just really valuable to see it from that side.
I assume a big part of that is working with talent, but also maybe the talent of that level, right? Because I think, you know, for a lot of actors that might watch or listen to this, I think, unless Tom Cruise is listening, which I don't think he is, a lot of them are at a certain level where we're kind of working our way up and into the game, and we've got credits, but we're not maybe at that star level. So that's a different kind of set of puzzles and crises, I guess, that you have to work with. So I don't know if you can speak to that. You don't have to drop names, but when you're talking about crises, what are we talking about here? Because I'm assuming it's not just production based and like finance based, it might also just be different levels of problems based on stars that you're working with.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, he knew every client so well, and he knew their you'd send an offer to one client and they would decline it, and he would say, "Don't go back to the producer yet, just give it a day, give it a couple of days," and so we wouldn't go back to the producer, and the producer would be phoning, "Do you have a response? No, we don't have a response yet." And I'd be thinking, "Well, we do have a response, it's a no, why don't we just say it's a no, and then the producer can get on with somebody else." But then after a couple of days, the actor would call back in and go, "You know, I've been thinking a little bit more about that offer, and actually I've read the script again," and he just knew, so then the client ended up saying yes and doing it. And it's just that he just knew. He knew how to speak to them. He knew how to, and again, so these were absolute top level clients. And sometimes he would know not to shout at them, but he would put them in their place and know how to just tell them that they're being ridiculous. I think it was just about having a vision for each of his clients and a vision for their career. And it's a long-term vision. And then just being able to deliver it, I suppose. I mean, he would be very good at advising an actor, and there were new actors too, the people that knew people that he would sign, and he would absolutely say, go and be the spear carrier at the National Theatre for a year, because that's going to do you a world of good, rather than going and doing a couple of commercials over here or something like that. You know, you'll make a load of money out of these commercials, but go and do this, get paid nothing, but be on stage with all these other actors, and you will see that will do you, you know, that's going to help your career more in the long term. And just lots of, just piecing that, it's just that sort of seeing things from a slightly, not elevated position, but just being able to kind
removed,
of go,
well, I guess, right? Like
kind of, yeah, and kind of go, I know I've got this director over here and I've got these actors here and I know this writer and I know these producers that are looking to do this, and really putting it all together and
playing the long game, I think.
It seemed so new. Well, yeah, it was just great. It was just a really, fascinating, again, just an absolutely fascinating time, just to be able to be on those phone calls, because kind of my job was just to sort of sit in on lots of these calls between studio heads and massive agency heads and movie stars and these directors, again, that were just extraordinary name directors, and listen in on the conversations. And I would be making notes, because whatever my boss promised, he said, okay, I'll send you that script, I'd be the one that had physically kind of executed that. So I'd have to listen to everything. And but just again, being able to, again, it was like a little film school where I could just sit there, absolutely, my eyes, huge eyes going, I cannot believe I'm sitting listening to this phone call with the director, the general of the BBC here, this A-list actor there, I've got a top agent here, and a, you know, and another executive producer over here that's just, again, legendary. And it was it was such an amazing experience. I mean, it was really hard work and very long days, and there was some kind of screaming and shouting, but not really that much. And I think because everybody knows that this guy, he wasn't abusive. He was just
vocal.
And you could kind of see, because there were times where he would have, you know, there'd be six or seven. I mean, I used to control, I think I controlled four phone lines into the office, and he had two other assistants, and each of them controlled about four phone lines. And we would, when we had somebody on the line, we would just call out. We were all in this kind of, this office with open windows and things that we could shout in. And so there were times where I would literally have the absolute head of the BBC. I would have the top client. I would have one of the producers from Working Title who had an office upstairs waiting for him, and I would have his wife. I would have all four of those people waiting to speak to him, and he would have to decide which one he would accept and which three of those he was going to say, you're not important enough for me at this moment, I'll call you back. And so of course your head's going to explode when you have these four people that all want your attention and all think that they should get your attention straight away. And I really understand why it's kind of like, oh, what am I supposed to do? Why have you got those four people? Why, you know? And it's and then sometimes there were even more, because the other people in the office would have people, and it'd be just like, you just cannot, you can only speak to one of them. And
you're managing and organizing the chaos somehow, I guess.
Yeah. And it was just, like I said, incredible to watch how he works and how, just how he got through his list every day. And, it was a really good, amazing experience, and amazing to see from the other side.
And so obviously you picked up a lot of stuff by doing it, and also I guess just osmosis, right, of being with Jeremy and then with the agency, and then I guess you just by being in that world and that environment, naturally going to pick up so many things. Was that then a natural spur to then eventually go at some point, like you did, okay, but now I want to sort of branch off and do my own thing? What was the sort of, I guess, thought process around that at the time, and what spurred you on to go and get back into casting?
Yeah. I promised myself that I would work for a year for the agent. So the day I started, I booked a trip for myself, literally 1 year later, kind of, it was right at the beginning of January when I started in January, and I booked a trip to America, because I like traveling a lot. And so I thought, I'm going to give that's what's going to focus me. I can do this job. It doesn't matter how hard it is. In 1 year's time, I'm off for 4 or 5 weeks. I'm going to travel around America. And so that was my, that was what I was always looking forward to. And so, I was so fortunate. The way the timing worked was because about 6 months into my into the job, the agent decided he was going to leave being an agent. I mean, he was absolutely at the top. You could not be a bigger agents. But he was going to go off and run a huge media company for one of his clients. And that meant putting a lot of money together from other investors and setting up a whole different kind of company. And so it was just, again, a fascinating time just to see how that is managed and how all of that works. And so in a way, we both left the agency, not together. Because, I mean, he doesn't care because he went off and became this, he went off and started running this big company. But I kind of left at the same time thinking, no, I'm off on my my lovely adventure now. And I quite early on in that adventure, I was in a small car crash. It wasn't terrible, but I hurt my leg and I cut my head and I broke my arm. And we were, I was in America and I was staying, I was up in the Rockies in Colorado. That added a few weeks onto my trip. And I'd always intended, I mean, again, it's a long story. I'd always intended to get a bicycle and just cycle around a bit because I like cycling around. And I've never had that much money, but I do like traveling. And traveling by bicycle is incredibly cheap and you get to really see stuff. And so after the car crash, I thought, oh, can I still do this cycling? And I thought, well, yeah, you know, damn well, I'm going to do my cycle ride because that's what I'm here for. And I moved down from Colorado and I went to Tucson, Arizona. And I've been to Tucson a few times and I don't know why, but I'm really fond of the city. So I recuperated in Tucson and I bought myself a little bike and I did some small bike rides. And eventually I kind of went off and did I'm going to go off and do my trip. And I ended up staying away for about a year and a bit. I probably stayed away a little bit too long, but I kind of went all the way down. I cycled all the way down to Brazil and had lots of lovely adventures. Wow. And it was all just fantastic. You know, I'm a kid on a bike and it's just like, here I go, I'm going to do what I want. And, so I was away for about a year and a bit, and when I came back, I just thought, now what am I going to do? You know, I've had this great life so far, and I've worked in casting, and I've worked in with the agent, but I still wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And again, just by good fortune, I knew somebody from along the way. You know, you meet lots of people, and you have your kind of network, and they're all pals. And somebody told me that there was a job going at Scar Films, which was run by Matthew Vaughan and Guy Ritchie. It was their head of development. And so somehow I managed to go in and just talk my way into a job there as head of development, which was, and I guess because I knew actors and I knew agents and I guess I was pretty good with scripts and things and all of that kind of stuff. And kind of working for those two was just great because, again, it's such a door opener. You just say, I'm working for these guys and send me some scripts to read and I'll have a read of them. And so I met lots of filmmakers and I met lots of writers and directors. Anytime I was interested in something, I could just follow it up. So, that was really good fun. But I knew, again, it probably wasn't going to be for me. But it was another fantastic experience in production to see how production kind of works. And then it really kind of, anyway, I left there and I thought, I'm going to start off my own company. And I set up my own little production company. And I had a few things that were in development. And I had some really cool stuff that was, I mean, I had an amazing director attached to something and a little development deal with Working Title and a few other development deals I was able to kind of set up. But again, I'm not a rich man and I'm not very good at, it's just a, asking other people for money. I'm good when somebody has given me a chunk of money. I'm very good at managing that, but I don't like going and asking for the money. So that made me a terrible producer because sure. that's really part of the job. And anyway, long stories. I mean, these kind of story. Long story was that I then went off and was traveling again, and I found myself. I went with my wife to Nepal for a while to make a documentary about something, and then we. It is really long because. Anyway, we had an apartment, another part of the story, we bought an apartment in Poland over the years. My wife is she was my girlfriend then, but my wife is a writer and she got a great book deal and she got a chunk of money. And so she said, right, let's go put this money into an apartment somewhere. And we ended up buying an apartment in Poland. And so we got back from Nepal. It sounds like we just gallivant around and don't do anything, but it's honestly, we're usually kind of very poor, always kind of right on the edge of existence, but we kind of go, oh, we've got a few hundred pounds, let's get, or look at this cheap flight for £300 we can get to Nepal, let's go. So we do these kind of things, but we'd Anyway, Jeremy called me when I was in Poland, where I wasn't really doing very much. I was kind of editing this documentary, but really just killing a bit of time. And Jeremy was away. And I'd kept in touch with Jeremy all the time because he was not just a work mentor, but he just became a really good friend and just a life mentor, I suppose, just someone who lived life to the full. And we'd been on various adventures. Actually, part of that cycle trip between Tucson, Arizona, and Brazil involved Jeremy. I called Jeremy. I was in Costa Rica. And I called Jeremy and said, Jeremy, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm not doing anything at the moment. He said, well, I'm in Costa Rica. Do you fancy coming for a visit? And honest to God, the next day, Jeremy arrived in Costa Rica. He just went, yeah, I'm coming. I'm coming. Where should I go? San Jose Airport. And the next day he turned up. And so we had some adventures in Costa Rica. So I'd kept in touch with Jeremy all the time. And anyway, we're in Poland. My wife and I are in Poland. And Jeremy calls him and says, listen, could you go and look after the office? Because he was in South Africa at the time working on a film. And he said, there's somebody in the office, but she's quite kind of new. And it'd be just good to have someone a bit more experienced. And I hadn't really worked for Jeremy. Again, it was probably for about 7 or 8 years. And I hadn't even considered going back into casting. And he said, could you go back to the office, you know, just maybe for a week or so, because I'll be back. I'll be back, but I just want someone there that kind of knows how everything works. And I thought, well, yeah, fair enough, that's fine. And so I went from Poland back to England. I stayed at Jeremy's house. Because Jeremy's so brilliant, he always lets people have his key. And I'd just go, there's my house, go and make yourself at home. So I stayed at his house. And after a week, he called in, said, oh, no, listen, I'm delayed here. It's probably just another few days, like a week, maybe two max. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, sure, I don't mind. I'll stay a little bit longer. And this kind of went on and on. And it must have been about 2 or 3 months that Jeremy stayed away. And every kind of couple of weeks, oh, can I just be another week or two? And he loves traveling too. And so I could see that he didn't want to come back. But during those kind of couple of months, I was... again, it was kind of like, wow, I love this. This is great. I knew how to do everything. And I kind of, so I'd really come full circle. And so even though I started in casting and then I kind of left and did a few other things, again, by pure good fortune with Jeremy being away and him just thinking, oh, well, I'll ask Manuel to go back and look after the office. All of a sudden, I kind of realized how much I loved casting and working with actors, all the agents, all the assistants that we used to go and get drunk with and things, break, you know, kind of blag our way into parties and things. All of them had now become kind of big agents and a lot of producers' assistants that I'd used to work with had all become producers. And so everyone had kind of moved up a level. And it was just brilliant to kind of go back in and kind of, the job hadn't really changed. There was a few new actors around, but it didn't take long to kind of learn who the new kids on the block were.
Sure.
And I just really enjoyed it. And so when Jeremy came back, I said, oh, Jeremy, I love this. Can I stay? And he was, again, gracious enough to say, of course, you know, let's work together for a little while. So that's kind of then what brought me back into casting and made me 100% realize this is where I'm really glad I did the other. I mean, you know, I often liken it to sleeping around. It's kind of like you have your first love. But because it's your first love, you think, but I've got to sleep around. I've got to check some other things out. And so I did that. I slept around and did a few other jobs. But then when I went back, my first love took me back. It was like Jeremy said, yeah, come back and have a look at casting. And only because I'd done all these other things, I went, this is where I fit. This is exactly my position in this business is here, kind of this this little middle ground between actors and productions and all of that. And so, that was probably about 13 or 14 years ago. And I think when my wife and I then had our first child, that was when I just had a conversation with Jeremy and he just said, listen, you should go and set up on your own and be your own boss now because you've got a kid and you're going to want to decide what you want
to do. Oh, so was that his idea or had you been thinking about it?
It was a little, I guess, I suppose at some point, I always thought at some point I would go off and be my own casting director, but it was just, I think there's always that fear and that leap and like, oh God, but do I really, you know, will I ever get any jobs and what will happen? But I think it was a bit of a bit of both of us just kind of, but Jeremy it felt like a kind of a mutual thing that I should just set up on my own and be a little bit more in control of the things I wanted to work on and didn't want to work on and just hours and things like that so that I could spend time at home if I wanted and things like that. And so that was probably about 10 years ago that I sort of set up on my own. But thank God, it seems to have gone all right. It's kind of, it's gone all right. I get my jobs and I get my, I have my producers and directors that I work with. And things like that. So yes, that's good. Sorry, that's such a lot. I told you it's a really long origin story.
But I've been just sat quietly because I'm absorbing it, going, I knew he had an interesting story, and I've read up on your bio and I knew a bit, obviously, about it. But now you're filling in all these extra bits, and I'm thinking, geez, like, I said there was one movie at the beginning. There's about three. it was like your own version of The Alchemist, you know, Paulo Coelho's version, where you've kind of, you know, done your little Santiago thing and you've kind of started off and you've started at one point, gone all the way around and then come back to that sort of first love.
The first thing, yeah. And even now, honestly, I still absolutely, you know, pinch myself most of the time, just kind of going, really, is this the world I live in? I would never, even as a 15-year-old or possibly even as an 18-year-old, I would never in a million years have thought that I would be doing this and working in this sort of business and sort of have the job I have. I would never have dreamt it, I suppose.
But more rewarding, I suppose. And the interesting thing is, a lot of people that I speak to who are in casting say that, well, you know, they started out as actors or they knew that they wanted to get into casting and it was much more clear cut for many of them. Whereas with your example, your story is the antithesis of that. You're saying you just had a passion for film, but you didn't really look at it as a career that you could get into. And obviously, you know, let's be real, like going to LSE is no mean feat. Like, you don't just waltz into LSE. That's a very kind of, you know, you have to know your stuff to get into school like that. And I don't know, at the time, was it a weird period where you were kind of figuring out what you wanted to do? Were there external pressures from family having, you know, got the LSE thing? And then you say, well, actually, I'm going to pivot away from the business side and forego my degree and go into this totally other world. What was that?
No, my parents have been brilliant. My parents are Spanish immigrants, so they're both Spanish. And so I was born in England. I was born up in Manchester, but to both my parents are Spanish, and they were in the restaurant business. I mean, both my parents left school when they were about 13, and they didn't have any kind of proper education after that. I mean, you know, they grew up in Spain, and my mum, I think, left school at 13 and started working and doing things. They were just anything that us kids wanted to do was fine by them. And so I just had a knack for being able to do examinations. I've always been good at cramming it's a brilliant skill, but you can't ask me anything about economics because I'm very good at answering some very specific questions. And I would work through old papers and I would figure out, and it was kind of gambling. I would kind of go, they always ask a question about this subject, this subject, this subject. So I will figure out how to answer that subject, that subject, that subject. And hopefully that's going to come up on the paper. And if it doesn't come up, I am absolutely screwed because I genuinely don't know anything about anything. And if you'd have kind of tried to twist me away or ask me anything about any, I wouldn't have been able to do it. These very specific things didn't come up. And I just, again, amazing good fortune. I ended up with a really good degree. It's like a good degree. But the moment the examination finished, I mean, every time I would take all my work with me, I would cram like mad. And then I would go and do the examination. And I used to take all my papers with me. And as soon as I walked out the examinations, my ritual was find the nearest trash can, the nearest bin, throw it all in. And I would never, it's like, I don't, that's, it's gone. It's,
well,
it's in
and
my
you know,
past.
How much of that do we need anyway? That's a thing. Like, I got a uni degree and I don't think I've applied more than 2% of it in real life at all.
Yeah.
It's great.
I guess that's exactly. So, you know, I came out with a really good degree. And so that was good. And so I think my parents were, again, my parents, they wouldn't have cared either way, but it was like, no, I got a pretty good degree. And I still think they don't quite understand what I do for a living because it's kind of just so alien to them. But my mum and dad have always been brilliant. Just as long as the kids are happy, it sort of doesn't matter. But especially when I got off on, you know, you look back now, I've got kids now myself, but I look back and think, God, there were times when I did another trip once where I was in Africa and I probably would, I kind of backpacked all around Africa. And I kind of, there were times where it would be 5 or 6 weeks between phone calls to my mum where she would not know at all. I mean, again, there are no mobile phones or anything. she would have absolutely zero idea where I was. And I, again, was getting into all sorts of scrapes, and I was camping in really dangerous places and doing all sorts of stuff. And then every 6 weeks, just calling Mum and just kind of going, yeah, hi, Mum, all breezy, nice, everything's all fine. And, you know, 5 minute phone call, off I went, and it'd be another 6 weeks before she heard from me again. And I just think, oh my God, how can I have put my mum through all of that?
She must have been stressing. I mean, especially, like, you know, family's important everywhere, but in Spain, like, yeah, the culture is, family is everything. So she was probably stressing and swearing under her breath every 2 seconds.
I can imagine she's there. I mean, again, she's there sitting by the phone for 6 whole weeks, just waiting for it to ring. And then she tries to sound super casual. Oh, yeah, hi, yeah, you just happened to phone. But I know now, looking back and talking to her about it now, and especially now, my kids are little still, but still you just think, God, yeah, the things I am, yeah, the kind of crazy things that you do as a kind of growing up. So, no, they were fantastic. My parents have always been fantastic. And I've been lucky that I can talk my way into things, I think, and then hopefully deliver as well. Hopefully, kind of back it up.
Yeah, you might be underselling yourself a little bit. I think, you know, I grew up in Spain. I think the Spanish culture is very much about being a conversationalist. Everybody kind of talks and is very amicable, but there's style, but there's also substance that you need too. Like,
yeah, I think that's
you have
it.
To back it up.
I have to kind of back up and deliver, yeah. And I think you know that you, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So there's been a lot of shifts at the time that when you first got into the industry to now where we are now. Obviously, the most notable thing is going to be, you know, the just role of technology and the impact that's had on things. But what have been some of, I guess, maybe the big paradigm changes that you've seen that have really impacted the way that you have worked throughout that period? Because, you know, I'm sure looking at it now versus a decade ago, it's a different world.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, self tapes have revolutionized the way I work. That's for sure. I do enjoy the history of the business, and I've always enjoyed stories about older casting directors and older agents and kind of the history and who worked for who and all of that kind of side of things. And I think I've been lucky that I've seen that when I joined, casting was done in a particular way where we had spotlight directories and we would meet actors in audition rooms and all of that kind of stuff. And it was way before internet and way before, you know, to begin with, we had, you know, fax machines were this great, extraordinary kind of game changer where instead of having to physically send copies of scripts, we used to spend so much time photocopying and then either posting or it's incredible thinking back now, just how many bicycle couriers. Sometimes if you're doing auditions, you would be sending hundreds. It would become this logistical enterprise where you would have 100 scripts that were going all around London and different couriers would be coming to pick them up and take them to actors' houses.
You've got actors sending in CVs and headshots and you probably deal with all that. I know in the States there was the whole postcard thing. It was more American, but they would send in the postcards all the time and just all the physical stuff.
Yeah, there was stuff. And then suddenly everyone started getting VCRs, video cassette recorders, and kind of home video cassette recorders. And so that was another kind of revolution where people would again send via post or with a courier a real cassette that we would stick into a machine, and they would have a little note there saying, please fast forward to minute 23 and 14 seconds. And we would sit in front of the machine and wait a few minutes because it wasn't a fast process. You would watch the little clock going and you'd sit there for a few minutes as it trundled towards minute 23 or wherever we'd been asked to go to.
And you go a bit too far, then you got to go back a little bit.
And then, yeah, and it would be just something that had been recorded from TV a few nights ago, and it would have all the commercials, it would have everything in, but you would at least eventually find the scene with the actor. And it was like, wow, this is incredible. What a revolution this is that we can now see the scene from the actor, even if we didn't see the TV show. So that was great while it lasted. And then there were showreels when people started editing together these things. And then there was the internet so that we could start actually watching showreels online. And all of these developments have been fantastic. And obviously email was fantastic because then we didn't have to be sending scripts all the time. And we could send a full script. If you were sending out 100 scripts, it became a real kind of, again, a logistical problem that, gosh, to send 100 scripts, you would have to photocopy 100 scripts. And we're all using photocopiers that would jam and we'd have to photocopy people around. And it was so expensive. So, so you'd start just sending 2 or 3 pages to an actor and then they wouldn't know what the whole thing was about. Anyway, so email was great. I think now we've got we've kind of come past all of that, and I think now self-tapes are, for me, just fantastic. It's not a, I always think, I mean, it's a step one. Self-tapes are a step one, so I don't think you'll find anyone in the world that loves them more than I do, but it's not the be-all and end-all. For me, it's just step one, and it's just something that it just sort of, it just allows me to really throw my net wide, give lots and lots of actors opportunities, and really just kind of explore a role and kind of have lots of out-of-the-box ideas and lots of, just kind of go wild a little bit with roles, because I'm aware that it's a lot of work for the actor, but at those kind of stages where I've not, when I have the director in person, there is a real kind of ticking clock there. I'll only have that director for a certain amount of time, because all the other departments are kind of pulling the director in all sorts of different directions. So the more I can do before kind of having them for a few hours, the more kind of work we can sneak in, is it's great for everybody, for the actors, and it's just, it becomes so much more efficient. But it does mean I definitely always want to see actors in the room, even if it's a one line role. I hate when I'm sort of forced to or put in a position of having to cast from a self tape. It's because for me it's like, no, the self tape is good for some things, but we need to get actors in a room and test them that way, and ideally then even recall them and get them in a room with other actors and test people that way as well. But
I know the obvious question that I think a lot of people might have listening to that now with the current climate we're in is, you know, in your crystal ball, Manuel, what do you see maybe happening post lockdown with that? Do you think that there will be a period where we might not have back in the room right away, which is likely, and that you may have to be casting from self-tapes? Or
yeah, I'm sort of dreading it, to be honest, because I do feel that we may try and do that, but I'm sort of resisting it as much as I can at the moment, because it just seems that I am kind of resisting it, but I'm aware that I may be end up being left behind, so to speak, because it's kind of, I don't want to be in a room with a whole bunch of actors. I don't want to have to make a trip into London do that just yet. And also, just in terms of safety, in terms of filming, I'm still not convinced that we've worked out quite that yet. At least in this country, though, that it's kind of good for crews and cast to kind of be thrown in together.
Well, some productions I saw, they're saying they're going to start like at the end of June. They're going to start filming again, some of the sort of serialized productions, and I guess they have some idea of how they're going to do it. I think they're looking at, I know, like in Australia, Neighbours restarted up, and I think in Korea, some productions, but
yeah, I think
we don't know.
No, I think some territories is kind of different. I think Australia and New Zealand, because they're so remote and because they've handled everything so well, it feels like, yes, you can kind of, the risks are kind of much less than they are here. But I just think until at least in the UK, and I know in Europe, I think in Denmark, they're looking at restarting filming. And again, some of these long established shows that are well funded and or funded by a massive parent, that they can afford to quarantine, and they may not have insurance, and they self-insure because they're working for some kind of, you're part of some massive corporation, and so, you know, you may not need things like completion guarantees. But in my world is a mostly independent film, and on an independent film, not only do you have to have your cast and crew all insured for health, because what happens if your director falls ill, or your not just from COVID, but from anything? So you have directors and you have anybody. So I'm kind of thinking, well, who's going to insure, who's going to kind of write in, which insurance companies will write it in at some point, I suppose, but I'm not sure they're doing
that. Not anytime soon, yeah.
Yeah, you just think they're always going to exclude that. So there's that massive risk from a health point of view. But then there's also the completion bond, which, again, most projects will have, because most projects have like an insurance, I don't know if you know what a completion bond is, but most projects, because you're maybe using $3 or $4 million of somebody else's money, you go to, it's like a special insurance that a completion guarantor or a completion bond, they will look at the budget, they will absolutely take apart the budget of the film, and then they will sit with the producer, and they will sit with the director, and probably sit with the first AD, the kind of the real nuts and bolts people who make a film and kind of cost everything up. And the completion guarantor will absolutely go through everything with a fine tooth picking, and by the end of this process, really rigorously interviewing the director, figuring out, you know, do you have enough money to make the film that you want to make in this budget? And at some point they sign off on it and they go, great, yes, we will guarantee that you can make, you know, after all this process, we will guarantee this budget will be £3 million, and you've got the £3 million from somewhere else, and you will be able to deliver the film for that cost. And if the film goes over,
and well, that's within that cost, within a certain time frame too, right?
Like, yeah, within a time frame. And if there are any overages, then it's the completion guarantor. They pay to complete the film. They kind of then take over, almost they take over physical production. So most of the time you pay your fee to the completion guarantor, but you never use it. It's just like an insurance. You pay them, and it's quite a hefty fee, but you know that if something went terribly wrong, or the director, just for whatever reason, everything goes wrong, then the completion guarantor steps in. Right. And again, I just can't think. So a lot of public money, you can't get money from public funders unless you've got your completion guarantee, because again, it's just a safety. It's everybody kind of just making sure everything's above board and good, and it's all going to happen. So again, with those sort of things, you just think, God, who's going to do that? Because again, if one of your crew tests positive, yeah, do you shut down the whole production? Do you not? How's it going to affect people's schedules? If one actor going to another project, or even the DP going to another project, so there's all these kind of logistical things. But of course, they will sort all of this out, and they will be. Life will return to some kind of normality, or a different kind of normality, and of course, things will get filmed. But I think, in particular, in the UK, I think we're quite behind a lot of compared to some other countries, we're a little bit behind. And so I think there's going to be a certain element of kind of wait and see as well, and wait and see how it works in these other territories. But there's no doubt everything's going to have a real big shake-up, I think. And it's not necessarily for the bad. I do look for the positives, and I'm very optimistic that actually in my field, which is independent productions, I think it's going to go through I think it could be really good, because
that's interesting.
People need products. All the streamers need products, absolutely. And I think because of this, so studios are always going to carry on, and they're going to try and to make their big budget films. But I certainly think lower budget films will, because the streamers don't need. I mean, it's great when they've got their movie stars, of course, and they need a certain number of movies with big names in them. But the streamers work on a completely different model now, and they don't. The whole point of having a movie star in a film was really to get publicity, and so that your film would kind of garner publicity around the world because you had a big star in it. But the streamers they don't. I mean, obviously they need publicity, but the streamers are in control of their own publicity, and they can very easily direct market to their own members. Already they have all that data, and they know who likes a shoddy science fiction film on a Friday night. They know exactly who that audience is, and they can reach that audience by email so easily. And so if you can deliver them a something that they stick into their algorithm and go, yep, we budget for that low budget, we know we'll get enough views, and that all kind of works. So I think that might be really interesting, and it could generate lots of work. And I think, again, the star system might take a bit of a hit, because, and I'm not, I have no problem with that, because I think stars have had it very nice for a long time now. And a lot of times people are overpaid, and they're not bringing that kind of value to a project. But for whatever reason, the fees just keep going up and up. I think there's going to be a whole bunch of people that have probably paid off their mortgages and have a little bit of money in the bank. And I think they might sit it out for a year or two and just go, I don't need to work. And I'm 50 years old or 55 years old, and I've got a family. And it's like, do I want to risk everything for the sake of going to work on a project? And I think so. Hopefully, I mean, we'll see. I think so. Maybe some stars will take a step back just for a little while to see how things go. But that would probably hopefully mean more opportunities for other actors. And as long as the financiers, I think it's always, you know, if you look back at how, yes, what value really does paying this person so much money, did it really pay off? Did it really pay back the value? And I think lots of times it just doesn't. And you do wonder, why are you paying these people so much money? They, you know, maybe they're associated with a big TV show at the time or something, but genuinely it's not. It's always been a strange
I guess it's the idea kind of attention, right? Like some of these big stars have attention, or well, did have attention that reached so many people that they were a platform unto themselves, you know? And so from a marketing and branding perspective, product placement, all the rest of it, they can provide so many more eyeballs on the product than maybe was, you know, possible previously. But now you look at it and you think, as you're saying, with the algorithms, and you look at Facebook and Google and if you can market your movies on those platforms, yes, having the stars help, but you can actually tap into your audience and get attention for the right pocket of people. I think you'll have your tentpole films still there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting because the question that a lot of people seem to have been asking other casting people is, what do you expect to happen coming out of this? Do you think that there's going to be lots of famous and known and named actors, whatever that means, getting more of the jobs because production companies are going to want to recoup the lost earnings of this period and they're going to want to make sure they can get as much bang for their buck and name gives you that? Or do we think that there's going to be actually more opportunities for more people because more content's needed than ever because we've lost out on content? And it sounds like you're more in the latter.
Yeah, I'd sort of hope so. I'd hope that there'd be that sort of shakeup. And like I said, I think it'll be really interesting to see. I think the real star being paid even more because they'll know they're really. And again, if the company's winning somebody a huge amount of money, then of course that's great. But I think that they might look at the overall model and go, sometimes it doesn't work. It's not been working, it's been a bit hit and miss. And listen, I guess people have been making money, and as long as people are making money, they'll try and do something rather. And even with the old system, it was making money for some people, but it just wasn't. But it might not be making money for as many people as possible. And maybe it could. Yeah, maybe it could change. And I just think these things like completion, if your budget is low enough. And I don't mean kind of everybody doing things for absolutely nothing, but if your budget is low enough and you're funded by a Netflix or an Amazon or a Disney or somebody, then they don't need a completion guarantee. It's kind of it'll just be a different way of doing things. And like I said, if they can market certain things to certain people without it costing a fortune, and they just need lots of product because that's kind of how their business has started. Every week they've got to be able to kind of say, hey, here's like 10 brand new films and here's some more TV shows that you've never heard of before. They need to churn through them. So yes, there's going to be huge demand for products. And I think good independent producers are kind of ready to step to kind of manage that and to do all of those things. Everything, even cinema chains are going to change, I imagine. Just the way people go to the cinema, and again, not necessarily for bad things. I mean, I think I was reading things that certain existing cinema chains would probably fold because their business model doesn't really work. And especially, I think studios have been releasing stuff online and kind of realizing actually we can make a chunk of money just releasing this online and bypassing the theaters altogether. So I think all those old empty cinemas might end up being bought by Apple and converted into Apple stores, and it becomes a different experience. And Amazon shops and Disney in particular, you think, well, because I think rules are changing, especially in the US, rules are changing that the studios are now able to own cinema chains, where I think that had been broken off sort of way back when. But I think now Disney can want to own cinemas, and it just becomes a different experience. And I kind of get, I think we might get to a point where we don't pay to go there. I get an email from Netflix and it becomes very localized. They'll kind of say in where I live, they'll go, okay, we can email 500 people that all live within this cinema and just say, oh yeah, we've got Quentin Tarantino's thing on it. We think you're going to really like it. Come to the cinema. Here's your voucher, whatever. And that'll be kind of just part and parcel of our membership. When we go there, we'll be spending money on popcorn. It'll be profitable for them. So I kind of think, I feel that those streamers will end up buying. I mean, Amazon have got fingers in absolutely every pie anyway. Disney have got fingers in. They're not just movie companies. They are theme parks, hotels, cruises, everything. And I just think Amazon's the same. Apple is kind of the same. Apple just, it's not just, Apple, obviously they're conglomerates and they do all sorts of different kinds of business. And so I think there's just ways that, it's just going to be different. Which is exciting. I think it'd be exciting. Of course, it might all. We could get a vaccine in a few months, and then everything could just go really back to normal, and that'd be that. But if there's no vaccine, I think things will have to change.
And well, so, with or without, people have always been questioning that thing of how long can a Netflix sustain the amount of money they're investing in these projects when they're just working off of membership fees and no advertising that we can see. And so it is that idea of, at some point, more money has to come in from somewhere. Is that advertising money that they're going to start pulling in? Is it, you know, joint ventures with other companies that they can actually sort of make some money from to actually make these projects? Because some of the money they've been dropping is insane. And then from an independent filmmaker's perspective, does that mean your only outlet is going to be go to one of the big Goliaths, or is there a way for them to still get their indie film seen? Because it used to be your indie film is shown in the cinema. And if that's maybe not the new thing, then is the new way that you self-distribute it on YouTube? Like, there's so many different ways of how it could go, which is exciting, but also a bit unanswered at the moment, I guess.
Yeah. But that's good. That's not a bad thing. You know, it's not a bad thing. It's kind of things needed. Lots of things, I think, just needed shaking up a little bit. And,
exactly.
You know, so we have an opportunity, I guess, to kind of rebuild, but in a different way and using different systems and exploring different systems. So let's, you know, let's hope for the best, I suppose. Yeah.
So talking about shaking things up and sort of different systems, perfect segue. let's get to the acting habit, because I think from, you know, my point of view, that kind of in some ways has done that a little bit. Like, you know, you set it up and it's allowed people to sort of hone initially, the premise was hone on their self-tape technique, you know, running 3 weeks of it every day. But then it's kind of also got to that point where once you've done that, you're now bringing in other casting people to run 5-day workshops. And it sort of has taken that in-person version of doing a workshop with a casting person where you get one scene and a few minutes to now letting them, you know, work with you over 5 days, see you do more than one piece and connect people, especially at a time like this, from all over the world. And I think it's a bit of a game changer in that sense, specifically the location part, because not everybody lives in London or a major market to go to these workshops, and your platform allows everybody from anywhere. So I guess in some ways that's a thank you from not just me, but I'm sure loads of actors, because it's been amazing prior to the lockdown. And I think super helpful during the lockdown as well, because we all get something to do. But what got you into that? Like, what was I'm intrigued by the thought process with stuff. What was the thought process at the time that made you go, yeah, I'm going to try that?
Yeah, it was such a fun, again, as usual, like all of these things, it's just these, yeah, it's just like all of these things. It's just kind of good timing and various things. And I've always come up with magic. I've loved when I was a kid, before going off to university and before. I mean, when I was a kid, I was mad into computers. I love computers and I still love computers. And I used to do lots of programming with computers and things. And in a different life, I could have gone off and you know, worked in computer games. And in fact, when I work on games now, I'm so thrilled because it's two areas of my life that are coming together. But I am.
Sorry, what's the best game you've worked on then? What's the fanboy moment that you've had?
A couple of years ago, I worked on a Planet of the Apes game, and it was just great. It was an amazing, they kind of made it almost like an indie game, and it was for Planet of the Apes. It was Andy Serkis's company, but it wasn't a huge big. It was one of these games that they spent a fortune on. They really wanted to tell a different kind of story and tell it their way. And it was, but just going in and we did lots of auditions down at Ealing Studios, and it was all very kind of exploratory to begin with. We weren't quite sure not what we were doing. We knew what we wanted to do, but it was kind of new what we were trying to achieve with the storytelling and with the acting talent. And but it was just such a. I'm a kid in a sweet shop. Even when I go on a film set, I'm just, you know, too overexcited, going, oh my God, look at these cameras, look at all these things. But going into their studio and just seeing all these computers and all these kind of setups that they had, and just watching how they built the environments and things like that, it's just amazing. It just kind of blows your mind. So, that stuff is great. That stuff is great. But with the acting, I'd always been enjoying technology and messing around with technology anyway. And very early on, when I left Jeremy and set up on my own, I knew somebody who said, and this was probably about 10 or 11 years ago, and they said, oh, Manuel, you should get yourself a website. And it was kind of like, well, why did casting directors don't have websites? I mean, nobody really had a website. And they said, yeah, just get a website. So I thought, well, I'll get a website, because this guy was great. And I knew, you know, he was a smart guy, distributor. So I got myself a website, but I didn't really know what to put on it. So I just started writing these articles, and I would, which I just thought they're kind of, you know, how to what I like in audition, and what do I use props, and how do you learn lines, and you know, all of these kind of things that would be, I suppose, advice that I would give in a face-to-face workshop. I would write it all on my website so that people just kind of went, well, this is how I like to do my things. So I populated my website with lots of advice and lots of things, but always the big part of it was always about learn your lines for audition. And the best way of learning lines is to do it every day. Just treat it like a workout, and you do it every single day. Learn some lines in the morning and test yourself a little bit later. And if you're just doing that every day, your memory muscle just grows strong. And you know, you're an actor. What fun, you know, it should be fun to learn lines and come up with a character every single day. So I kind of was suggesting this on my website. And then my sister, her husband now, but her boyfriend at the time, is an athlete. I mean, he was an athlete. He's a retired athlete now, but he was a really good athlete, and went to the Olympics and whatnot. But he was setting up some online classes with his colleague, who's another amazing athlete, and they were setting up some kind of fitness online courses. So he was telling me about those, and I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. And he was saying, yeah, you should try and figure out a way of doing online courses. But I didn't really make the connection at all. Until I woke up. I mean, it was just a normal Saturday morning, and I have to, on a Saturday, I get a bit of a lie-in. Normally during the week, I get up early and I get the kids ready and get them off to school. Saturday, I have a bit of a line, but then I take my little boy to football. So I woke up in the morning and I thought, oh, I had an idea kind of overnight, but it was just like, oh, there's this, I've got an idea of doing this thing online, and it'd be kind of cool to sort out. So it was mulling it. And then I went to watch the football, took my boy to football and was watching him playing his football, but secretly on my phone as well, trying to figure out just the how to practically set up this idea. And it all seemed kind of quite simple. So when I got home from there, I kind of had a quick look and I thought, yeah, that all seems doable. I think I've got an idea for a course where I send everyone the same material, they send it back, everyone can see it, everyone can leave comments. That sounds like a good, you know, just a good setup. And I quickly invented this course. I actually, it was a 30-day one to begin with. And because on my website, I'd set up this thing on my website where people could just kind of log in and register so that I could, when I uploaded a new bit of material, when I sent a new web post, everyone would get notified. So I had a list of a few hundred actors that had signed up, so they would be informed every time. And I sent this thing saying, hi, I've developed this new course. It's 30 days long. At that point, I really only had the framework of it. I kind of had the idea, but I was able to set it up and say, yeah, I've got this thing. I'm going to start it on Friday. I mean, I did this, I think, on the Sunday or the Monday. So the Saturday, I kind of had the idea, researched how to do it. But then by the Monday, I'd emailed a bunch of actors and they started signing up, and it was kind of like, oh my God, they've started signing up. I bet, you know, I hope it works. I hope it all kind of works. And I hadn't even got all the pieces of material. I was kind of trying to, I then had a really busy week where I really needed to test it and test the system. And so it just happened so quickly. It was kind of within about a week or so, I'd set it up and people had started. And it was just great. After a couple of days, just watching everybody interact with everyone else and seeing all the different interpretations, it was just like, wow, this works. This is just this is great. And so I worked through that 30-day course with them all, and then I fine-tuned it. I kind of realized there were some things that didn't work as well as other things, and then fine-tuned it. And it's just great because you can just kind of, well, yeah, I just was able to fine-tune it for quite a long time. Even the next round, I would fine-tune it even more, and I would be asked certain questions, and then I could incorporate everything. And I keep fine tuning it now. I mean, it's just like a never ending thing. Somebody may ask something or point something out, and I can kind of incorporate it into a course. And I've had lots of ideas over the years, and lots of them don't ever work, and they never. And lots of technological ideas, and sometimes they just don't work. But this one just seemed to work. And it's a really, I don't know how to explain it. It's such a joyous thing, I think, for kind of almost everybody involved. So whether it's, I absolutely love seeing actors just kind of breaking out of their boxes and doing stuff that they never thought they could do, whether it's a technical side of things, because there's a lot of technical stuff that actually it's kind of quite simple once you get the hang of it. And so to have lots of actors, including especially older actors who are technophobes, or they claim to be technophobes, picking up things and going, oh my God, this is great. And I know I'm doing that. But not only from that technical point of view, but also just the creative kind of point of view. Just allowing actors to see other interpretations, and it just gives actors the idea. It just, yeah, you can see that, I mean, you kind of see behind the curtain of what it's like to be a casting director, where you get where we may receive 30 self-tapes or 50 self-tapes of this for the same role. And it's not that you're rubbish, it's just that there's so many really interesting interpretations and they're all a bit different and people bring different things to it. And actors can see that. And for me, it's like I said, just seeing actors attempting roles that in real life they wouldn't get to attempt and absolutely smashing it and just being brilliant. And that's really changed the way I look at it. I no longer try and typecast an actor or I no longer ever talk about type and say, yeah, you're an authoritative type, you can play these kind of roles. For me, it's kind of like, no, I don't want to know. I want to give you an opportunity and just to see how you do it. And even if you don't think you're right for it, have a go, because there's just something there. A lot of the times there's just something there. And especially if you almost cast against type, it's kind of just really interesting. And it's great that I can show that to a director, you know, so you have one of the roles is the role of a CIA director who you kind of immediately think of some gruff 50-year-old man or woman who's full of authority or whatever, CIA director. But I've seen people absolutely own that role who are 22 or 23 years old and play it in a completely vulnerable, totally different kind of way. But absolutely, it makes sense. They make it make sense. And I get goosebumps even just sort of thinking about it and kind of going, it's incredible. That's just incredible. An actor has that skill to make it sound as though that is exactly what the actor intended. And then you show that to a director and it can just blow them away. They can be like, wow, I hadn't even thought that it could be done anywhere near like that. And that just makes it really interesting. An audience is going to love that. So yeah, that's what, for me, running the courses, that's kind of what I get out of it. Mm. And I think other casting directors are now also, now that they see as well that once you give an actor a bit of a go, it's a bit of a chance, they're great. And then, yeah, actors just love it because they're acting every day and creating new characters every day and they're feeling part of the community. So I'm so, again, very fortunate that this wasn't one of those ideas that didn't really go anywhere. It was one that it just seems to be fulfilling from lots of different lots of different points of view. And and each course has its own personality, which, again, I just think is really lovely to see. It's just really interesting. You just bring people together from literally all over the world and you just see how they sometimes there are leaders in a particular group and sometimes there aren't any leaders at all. And it's just a slightly different vibe. And I think people have made kind of really good friends on it for, from all around the world and people helping each other out, especially back in the day when travelers, oh, I've got to go to LA and do this. I've been invited to do this. And it'd be just great. People would kind of go, great, come stay with me or I'll help you with this or I'll help you with that. It's been, it's been lovely sort of creating these communities and these connections. I still get an absolute buzz every time there's a new one starting and I look at where everyone's coming from and I kind of go, oh God, I've got someone from Melbourne. I've had people from Korea, from Fiji, from, you know, obviously lots from all around Europe, South Africa and lots in the US. And you just go, it's just amazing that somebody in Fiji is sharing their work with someone in Korea who's sharing exactly the same work with somebody in London. And and they're all kind of getting on with each other and seeing how the different approaches and learning so much from each other as well. Yeah, it's been a brilliant and I get no whinging directors and no whinging producers or no and in particular I get no whinging agents. It's such a lovely
it's just creative, right? I think that's from the actor side, you're not going in with any pretense of anything. There's no, I'm not going to book a job, I'm not trying to like impress anybody, I'm not trying to do anything, I'm just gonna have fun with it. I'm going to play. And then after, because again, it's the habit part, I think is the key that you've got in there where the discipline of doing gets stuff ingrained in your system. And it's not just the technical stuff, but also eventually you just go, screw it. Like, I'm just going to have fun. So if I do this one scene this way today and someone doesn't like it, okay. And I think that's the key thing too, for a lot of people, you start to realize that it's all just a matter of taste and it's so subjective that some people might like it. Some people might not like it. You can't control it. And I think that from a more mindset perspective for a lot of people is a big, big benefit too, because, sometimes you could do an in-person workshop, you get one scene, couple of minutes, and I've been there. You go walking away and you beat yourself up going, I don't know. Like, what did I do? Like, did I make the right choice? What does the right choice even mean? And now with this, you're like, no, I'll get another chance to play tomorrow. Like,
and you get to see, you know, you get, I mean, lots of people upload and go, oh, I'm not happy with this at all, and I didn't have time, and I did. And you kind of, I look at stuff without reading what people kind of write it. You know, I kind of watch it, and I think most people do. They have a look at somebody's upload, and they for the most part, they're blown away. It's kind of like, wow, that was incredible. And then they read, and they kind of read all these insecurities and all these things, and they kind of go, man, you are too hard on yourself. Stop it. And I think once every actor's been through that a couple of times, they kind of go, oh, yeah, okay. Just chill out, exactly. Just do, you know, have fun with it, and it is fun, and this whole thing should be fun and not stressy, and it is creative. Just you know, yeah, you're allowed to do whatever you like, and yes, and you can. I think it's this thing of just understanding what you can achieve, even with quite a short amount of time. And so, and I think because it's so, certainly the 21-day one, I think because it's so relentless that people start the first kind of week and they're doing 20 takes and 30 takes and they're spending hours and hours on it. But certainly by the last week, they're kind of going two or three takes max, boom, a job done in half an hour. And it's fantastic. We get to see what we need to see. It might be a little bit rough around the edges, but honestly, it doesn't matter. We absolutely see these characters and kind of go, yeah, you kind of see that there's enough there for us to know what, yeah, to kind of, see how you would be in that character, and then there's enough there for us to either say yes, come into the room, or realize that it's not quite what we're looking for. So yeah, I think it's anyway, yes,
it's an interesting point, because it's something Carly mentioned when she was on the other week, where she was talking about self-taping and auditioning in the room being totally different skill sets in some ways, because in the room we have you guys there to give us notes and feedback and direct us and help mold and shape what we're doing. But with a self-tape, you're effectively on your lonesome. And so to your point, you might end up doing 20 or 30 or 50 takes. And at what point do you know when to stop? At what point are you so in your head that you just don't know your ass from your elbow anymore? Yeah. Whereas with what you're doing and the habit, you eventually start to understand the nuances and trust that, yeah, two or three takes is not going to be any different to 322 takes.
Yeah, genuinely, it's true. It really is. It's true. And that you're yeah, and it's doing too many takes. It then takes forever to choose one, and then you beat yourself up, and then you kind of like bits from each take that you've done, and so you think, oh, I'll do one more where I incorporate this first beginning bit from this one and the end bit from that one, and then you're in a spiral of just kind of doing it over and over, and then you end up probably just picking the first or the second one anyway, and kind of going, okay, I'm just going to send that one. That's the one. That's the one I should send. So it's. I have no problem with actors doing hundreds if that's what they want, but I just think it's that it's not really practical in the real world, and that, you know, my dream would be for every actor to every day be doing three or four different self-tapes for different jobs, and not being stressed out, actually just kind of being able to partition their day and deliver a really good self-tape and then get the recalls and then get the jobs and things. And it should be about doing two or three every single day. It's not you know, it's not even just one a day. It should be like, yeah, man, you should be able to do two or three. I think I suppose you'd have to be a proper kind of jobbing actor, earning enough of a living where you didn't have any other kind of work. But yeah, that's what actors kind of want to reach that point where they, sure. Where yeah, they can just focus on the acting.
And the more we move into this kind of era of self-tapes, at least being the first stage of auditions before coming into the room, there's going to be more and more of a need to have that skill set down. So, I mean, beyond obviously the obvious of come and do like the workshop and things like that, what are your kind of golden bits of advice for people when it comes to self-taping versus in-room auditions, whether that's technical or whether it's just from more of a...
Yeah, I suppose, point? I mean, it's first of all, don't be afraid to send in a self-tape. And so, you know, we give all sorts of guidelines and lighting guidelines and background guidelines and things, but if you can't do that, or if your circumstances don't allow, if it's an emergency, still send in a self-tape. I'm always kind of genuinely broken-hearted when I meet an actor at a workshop and they say, oh yeah, you sent me that self-tape, but I didn't want to send it in because my camera wasn't quite right, or it was, you know, I can't find a plain back wall in my you know, I haven't got my setup sorted out. And it's kind of like, I don't care if you do it from, I mean, I've had self-tapes, I mean, literally from people in hospital corridors and in their cars and at weddings and things like that. I've had one self-tape, a real world self-tape that someone sent from a theatre corridor. And it wasn't, they weren't in a play. They were going to see a play and they'd forgotten about the self-tape and they thought, I want to just get it in. And so they just did it in a theatre corridor kind of during half time. And it's like, and I loved it. And it's kind of like, it, so I do, you know, I preach all these ways of doing self-tapes and kind of presenting your self-tape in a really great way. But, still send your self-tape, even if you can't do all the fancy stuff. But ultimately, if you have a bit more time, the main thing is I want to see your face and I want to see your eyes. And so you've just got to make those decisions in terms of eye line. You've really got to think, you've just got to get in your head framing and eye line, those two words, and really just make sure your framing is good and your eye line is good. So your framing, because these are in your control. You know, you can choose where you place people in the scene. And so you should place them quite near the lens so that we can see into your eyes when you're talking to them. And your face should, for me, it should kind of dominate the framing. You know, we should see we want to see your whole face from the top of your head and then, upper shoulders. But you know, we don't necessarily, unless specifically asked for, I don't need to see lots of your torso. I don't need to see kind of down to your belly button or your waist, because that just makes your head very small in the frame. And I'd rather be very close in to see your eyes. Obviously, there are exceptions and there are certain kinds of roles, and someone would give you clear instructions. But for the most part, it's kind of pick a spot near the lens, not into the lens, but just near the lens. And let us see your face, and let us see especially into your eyes. Don't cover up your eyes. That's the simplest thing. But I have, people don't have to do a course. They can just look on my website. Because like I said, all those things that I've put up, just lots of written stuff about his advice on how to do, how to do a good self-tape. But I think lots of people have got advice now, and most people kind of get the gist, indeed.
What about things like backdrops? I had a question from Jess here. Said, what are your thoughts on things like blue or gray self-tape backdrops? There's lots of talk of, different colors seem to be more of the rage at some point over the other.
Yeah.
Does it really matter, honestly, as long as it's plain?
Yeah, not to me. Honestly, it really doesn't to me. I mean, sometimes certain colors actually do look fantastic with people's skin tone and eye colors and things like that. And so sometimes, and I've seen kind of bright pinks and bright blues and bright greens and things. And sometimes people say, oh, no, that's a bit distracting. But honestly, if it's just a plain green background, I really don't mind. I kind of now do miss the days. I mean, I used to love the early days of self-tapes where I could see into everybody's houses and into their rooms, and I could read the books. I could not read the books, but I could see what books they had on their bookshelves or what CDs they had and things like that. I mean, I could see what kind of bed covers they had, because people would self-tape in their bedrooms and you could literally see everything, what was in their wardrobe, what they needed to wash. And I sort of miss those days now, because I very rarely get a self-tape that's got all that beautiful kind of detail in it. But no, backgrounds, and even I don't mind even crinkly backgrounds where people put a sheet up behind them if there's a few kind of creases in there. Man, I have tried to iron a sheet flat and it's so hard. It's like, God, yeah. So like as long as it's kind of reasonably plain. And again, it's just anything that's not distracting you. But even if there are just kind of stationary things behind you that are very plain and boring, like an empty shelf or something, I mean, that's kind of okay too, but it's, an ideal one is just a plain. I'm not too fussed by the color, and I haven't yet. I mean, you've got to just make sure that the color doesn't, that whatever you're wearing doesn't merge with the color of the background. But apart from that, I actually think actors should probably have a selection. I don't want them to spend money, but I just think that over the course of life, you come across certain things and you might be able to find, you might be changing the blinds in one of your rooms, or you might be about to throw away a poster. But if you reverse that poster, there could be just a beautiful, clean kind of back. I mean, I've seen actors just reverse posters and go, here's my backdrop. I kind of think that it's always good to have a choice of colors at some point. If you just build up a little library of different colors, so not fancy, expensive photographic backdrops that you have to pay money for, but just things that you come across just to have. You never know when you might prefer to have a darker background because of something you want to wear as a character, or just because it's just tonally fits the piece. But I don't, like I said, I don't want to kind of say that every actor now has to have 20 different backdrops and really think about, okay, now I've got to dress this, I've got to kind of spend time.
Yeah, we have enough to worry about. We don't have to be a production designer on the...
Exactly. Yeah. So, and the same with lights and things. It's yes, you can go and buy some fancy lights. And actually, lights are incredibly inexpensive these days. But But even if you're just using kind of lights that you've got at home already and lamps and things like that, that's kind of fine by me as well. You can you can usually I love all the homemade stuff, and I always ask actors to show me their behind the scenes, and it's again it's just a brilliant just to see the piles of books that people are resting their devices on, and just the contraptions that people come up with. You know, I had a wonderful somebody sent me who's been doing the course during lockdown in Spain, and she sent me just a lovely video that sort of says, look, you don't need, these are all things, I'm not allowed to go shopping, they can't order anything online. And she said, look, these are all the things that I found in my house to kind of create my studio. And it was just wonderful, just tiny little things. She didn't have a lapel mic, but she showed me how she used the mic on her headphones. Her headphones had a little microphone as a way of doing that, so that she could use that as a lapel mic almost. And it was just, it was just really inventive. And I'm a big fan of that. I'm quite stingy by heart, by you know, maybe it's all this traveling and budgeting and not having enough money to travel. And so I don't like spending money. And so, and I don't want especially actors to spend too much money on these things and feel that they need to spend money.
I think that's it. I think it's the idea of feeling like you have to if you want to be in the game, right? I think practicality is more important than just being flashy for the sake of it. Obviously, if you feel like getting something like that is going to help and you want to, then fair enough. But I think there's a nice thing of, it's the Robert Rodriguez approach to filmmaking, right? DIY and how Bear Grylls can we be? And still, you know, we're all kind of in a weird way like magicians with the stories we tell. Like, how can you create the illusion without giving away the trick? And it doesn't have to be, all fancy schmancy Kino lights and crazy stuff like that.
Exactly. I genuinely love it. I love when I see the, because, you know, it's easy to go and splash a bit of money and get the kit and then you've got a nice setup, but it's, I love when people are inventive about it. And they're the kind of people that when they're stuck on location somewhere, they're still going to be able to send a fantastic self-tape, because they'll be able to, they'll kind of go, right, I'm in this hotel room, I'll take this lampshade off here, I'll move this lamp over here, and boom, I've got a great, you know, they'll know how to do things on a shoestring. And and really, you know, that's like you say, that's the illusion of filmmaking. Nobody has ever got enough money in a budget. Not even Spielberg would ever have enough money in a budget. There is always a top limit where you can't, that's it, you can't have any more money, Stephen. And it's you know, there is always it's always sort of cutting corners and just making do on film, and making it, as long as it looks okay from the front, that's all that matters. And then it doesn't matter how shoddy it is. And you know, it's all just smoke and mirrors, isn't it?
I love that you said that, because it's a conversation I have with my filmmaking friends all the time, where we're like, oh, when we have budget, it'll be a different game. And we're like, well, actually, hold on, we'll just have more of the same kind of problems, but we'll just have money to deal with. And the sort of approach necessarily doesn't change in terms of how we set it up or how we go and create a shot. And last summer, the thing really hit home for me. I had to come back from the States on the Queen Mary 2. That sounds fancy, but it was only because my dad couldn't fly. He wasn't allowed to fly because of the doctors, and we're in California. And the only way to get back to the UK when you can't fly is a boat. So cool. we had a trek of our own. We Amtraked from LA through Chicago to Brooklyn, and then took the Queen Mary straight from Brooklyn to Southampton, 7 days transatlantic.
Wow.
So epic experience. And we're boarding the boat, and the woman, I remember getting an email about three weeks before, maybe, saying, oh, there's going to be a film shoot on the trip that you're on. Mild disruption is possible, but we're not going to, like, you know, we're just letting you know out of courtesy, but you won't really see them.
Oh, sorry, I lost you for a moment. Sorry.
Okay. I was just saying, they sent us an email about this film shoot, and they try to make sure there was really minimal disruption. And I'm thinking, me and my ego is going, what D-list like film shoot's this going to be on the boat? Forget all about it. I had more on my mind than that at the time. Get to the boat, we check in, and the woman at the check-in checks us in, and this is where I'm walking away. She says, oh, say hi to Meryl for me.
No.
And I'm like, hold on. It's like, yeah. Meryl Streep's on the ship. What? It's like, yeah, Meryl Streep, a crew, they came early. They've all boarded. And basically, it was Steven Soderbergh's new film about the Panama Papers. He did two. He did The Laundromat, Matt, with Meryl. And then he's got this other one, and they were filming this on the ship. So everybody's kind of a bit of buzz, like, where are they? Are you going to see them? And so one evening, I think on day two, I was on the dock to just catch the sunset. And all of a sudden, a couple of PAs come in, a couple of assistants. And then lo and behold, out of nowhere, a small crew appears, like five people, of which one of them is Soderbergh. And the thing, the moral of the point of the story is that it's a huge film. It's Steven Soderbergh, and he had no lights. He was using natural lighting from the ship, which was this beautiful, and by beautiful, I mean disgusting, sulfuric orange. And he was using the atmospheric light that we were getting from the sunset. And that's it. And he was trying to frame up the shot, him and his DOP. He was basically using the camera himself, and he had a sound guy. And that's it. And one PA to kind of warden off the onlookers. That's it.
Yeah.
And then they bring in Meryl, and Meryl does her thing. And obviously there was no dialogue, so it made it more condensed. But I just remember watching them work and going, cool, it's Meryl Streep, it's Steven Soderbergh, it's amazing. But also in the other side of it, what they're doing is no different to what I've seen us do on small independent films where they're still solving the same problems, and they're not using keynotes or anything for lights.
Yeah.
They're doing nothing. And I thought, what a lesson, because that just shows, like you're saying, even at Spielberg's level, you still have to have the raw, basic Bear Grylls approach down. Otherwise you're not going to survive with or without the budget.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think there is a sort of a pioneering spirit amongst filmmakers and a buccaneering spirit as well. It's kind of like whatever it takes, and let's not spend any money on it. Let's just try and, let's just try and get away with it. And do we really need this? Do we really need that? And as long as everybody's safe and everything. But yeah, I mean, I spoke a bit earlier about going on film sets. And I mean, and I am like a kid in a sweet shop, but I do, after you do kind of go, it looks terrible sometimes. I remember going on the Moon set, and it was, and I loved Moon, and I loved the scripts. And I remember going on set and going, oh my God, they're ruining it. What? This does not look like, I mean, it was a really cool set. I mean, I have to say it was beautiful, but the
soundstage.
But the soundstage, but the, yeah, but the actual setup, they, oh God, I can't remember. I'm reading The Martian at the moment. So with my little boy, and I keep thinking of The Hab. But they built a space station there on the Moon inside the studio, but lots of it was kind of painted to get perspectives and things like that. And so, and you just thought, no one's going to buy this. And of course you look at the finished thing and it just looks gorgeous. And certain things that absolutely were just kind of cardboard and, just ridiculous painting and things. You look at it and it's just like, wow, it looks so amazing and so real and glistening and beautiful. So yeah, I love, of course that's how business is make believe.
Magic of the movies. I don't think that's going to change with any of this. That's always the one thing we go for, that kind of wonder and disbelief, and kind of sometimes it's nice to know how it's made, but also sometimes it's nice to maybe just not know, because you want to just buy into the
well
magic.
This is and it's kind of funny, because actually this is something with me and actors. I've never thought of myself as any, I'm not an acting coach, or I could never teach an actor, somebody, how to act. And I don't know how actors do it. I have avoided studiously. I know there are certain theories and certain things, but I've never read a book about acting. I don't want to know about acting. I know the names of certain techniques, but I don't really know what they mean. And I don't want to know. And I have kind of kept myself shielded from all of that, because I still don't really know how an actor actually does it sort of properly, or and I kind of don't want to know. I love just the magic when somebody turns into a character and they just feel authentic and real. And it's like, wow, that's just a really clever thing that you just did. So, it's kind of funny. I love learning about how special effects are made and all sorts of different things. But it's kind of funny with acting. I've just thought, no, I don't want to. I don't want to do an acting course. I don't want to. I've got various books, but I don't want to read. I just don't want to know, because I think it would spoil it for me if I knew some tricks, I suppose. I don't know.
I think everyone's different anyway. I think some people have little tools and others maybe don't. And some, it's just they're harnessing light. Like, who knows what it is?
Yeah, instincts. But
I think that's the thing. It's sort of this. It varies for everybody. It's an emotional magic trick, I suppose, in terms of what we're pulling off. I always stick with though the Hugh Jackman quote where he said he thinks everybody should do an acting class at least once, but more because of the point of view that he says it's like the most deep, intense form of therapy you could ever have, which I can say is probably true. So there is life benefits that we can get out of it. Although, to be fair, with your story, Manuel, I don't think you need it. I think you've had more than enough amazing stories from your life's journey, which are pretty epic. As I say, I was aware, but not that aware. And I'm kind of inspired in some ways to pick up a bicycle and start cycling to Brazil. Not that I will, but but there's a part of me that
feels great fun. You should do. Everyone should do it. Oh, I've lost you again, Ashley.
No, you're back. Well, it's kind of, there we go. I think, yes.
I lost you for a moment. Sorry.
It's all right. Well, look, Manuel, I mean, we could talk for ages. I could happily talk to you more and more, but let's kind of wrap it up.
Wait, I can't hear you.
Can't you?
Oh.
Can you?
I've got you back now. You got me back.
Now, sorry. I was just saying
saying you were going to get on your bike and ride to Brazil. Get
on my bike and go to Brazil, and I'm going to take my phone just in case a self tape comes in, so I can can be ready to do it
from the road. Yeah,
from the road. It sounds very into the wild. Very, go and do that. Look, we could talk probably all afternoon, but I'm mindful that you have kids on a slip and slide that probably want their dad to jump out there with them again. So I guess, thank you just for sharing all the amazing stories. Thank you for,
thank you, Ashley, for listening, indulging me and letting me go.
I've loved it. I mean, at some point I'm going to come to you and say, Manuel, really, you got to option the movie, Manuel Piero, the trilogy.
I tell you, I've not even told you half of the stories, but it's
okay.
But yeah, maybe one of these days. I think everyone has stories, though. I think you spend time with people, and everybody has. Your story of you're driving across country with your dad and getting the boat and things. Everybody's got. I'm sure there were lots of cool things that happened on that, and it's
well, that's why we're great, aren't they? That's why we get into, what we want to do as filmmakers or storytellers or whatever capacity we're in the industry for. The artistry really is just an outlet to tell story, whatever aspect of that means to you. Look, I guess, Manuel, any kind of closing things for you? I kind of always give the last sort of moments to the guests. So any kind of message you want to impart to anybody watching or listening as a takeaway, whatever that may be?
Oh, no, I don't know about that. It's just that as we're talking about, and people being brilliant, and it is about kind of enjoying yourself. I mean, obviously there are things you can't enjoy, but I do just think it's if you choose to be in this business, like you say, it is about telling stories and even difficult stories, but ultimately it's just about enjoying the human condition. It kind of dawned on me, I mean, maybe it was just one of these moments, but it does dawn on me that we're so fortunate that we're able to communicate with each other. We are this species that can absolutely communicate, and we can make each other laugh, and we can give each other such pleasure to do it with very simple things. And it's like, why are we not doing this? Why do we not all wake up all the time going, oh my God, I can't believe that we're alive and we can do this. We're fortunate enough to do this. And so definitely, if you're in this, if you choose to be in this business, it should be lots of fun and engaging and just great. And you should, I should have prepared a much better, sign off. But I've always just thought, enjoy other people, because we're the only kind of species that sort of do that. And I do see it as the miracle that we are able to do that, that we can tell each other all sorts of stories and entertain each other. And so life should be filled with these things, these sort of stories, and finding out about other people. So how lucky are we to be able to do all of that stuff? Anyway, I know I'm just rambling on, and we should probably just sign off.
Yes, love that. Thank you so
good
much.
One.